My name is Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to the faces, the places, and the people who committed crimes that shaped the country that we became. This podcast, this particular episode, is dedicated specifically to a concept more than people so much. I do a huge amount of research for various things that I'm writing, and I use a variety of different locations as I'm researching. But I keep coming up with kind of a conundrum, I guess, where I'm researching and I find this incredible story, and I'll be, you know, swapping back and forth between criminal records, court hearing papers, wherever they exist, and then newspaper articles. A lot of the time, it's inconceivable to us now, but a lot of the time when newspapers were reporting some sensational crime or another, they would report it, but they'd also report the witnesses and, you know, the periphery, sometimes jury members. And there were such few guidelines on what newspapers could or couldn't print. And often you'll find this article that says something like, a person attacked the house of such and such, and they did these horrible things to them during the night. They're located at, and then they'll read their actual address, 23 Johnson Street, Fitzroy. Like, they actually name the person's address, almost as though, hey, other crooks, if you weren't aware, this is where someone lives, and they had money on the premises that was stolen, right? So this happened a lot. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about one particular case and why this creates a concern for me now, in a lot of the cases, 100 to 150 years afterwards, right? It links to the present today. So this podcast I'm going to call, it's the same, I'm going to give this podcast the same title as a chapter from one of the Dawn of Crime series of books. And this is called From the Fires of Hell. A very dramatic title. It's a good title. And I named it that because I wanted to write a whole book on arsonists. I began researching them, and it's a bit of a harder one to research, and maybe I'll get down to, you know, doing that another day. That's one of my aspirations. But this story was one of the interesting stories that came from that, and it's in one of the first volumes of The Dawn of Crime. Check them out on the internet. Just Google my name, Roy Malloy, and The Dawn of Crime. But it's a story about a young girl. And the act itself of committing a crime on the impulse, you know, like an impulse of passion, it's been a part of human culture since, you know, Cain killed Abel. There's your first real crime of just uncontrolled rage. And it's been an acceptable defense sometimes, even in French culture, where they say, you know, under the right circumstances, if you just explode and kill someone, that's okay if it's in this context. Creme de mur, I think I'm saying that right, crime of passion. But there's one story in particular that's it's set in Ballarat, and it involves a young girl. Now, there's a context and a backdrop to this. The close approximate living conditions of a lot of people historically often made for situations that we don't necessarily face so much in modern day Australia, particularly in the city centres, where, if anything, we suffer a lot from isolation, where people never speak to each other or see another human being, and I'm going to say specifically right now in lockdown. But this is a story that's set in that kind of environment. And it means that you've got a household where you've got a huge amount of people all living together. And it creates this kind of subculture in the house. So in this context, you get a situation where there's a young girl, and she was born onto a farm. Her family weren't poor. They were reasonably wealthy. She finds herself living in a residence in Ballarat. And Ballarat at the time, in the 1890s, was suffering the same as everybody else. There was a massive depression that hit Australia in the early 1890s when the stock market crashed. And people who were poor already became, like, excruciatingly poor. So she's a part of this kind of culture of poverty that sweeps the nation right about that time. And so she's living in Ballarat. And she had been previously, I assume, living with her own parents on a farm. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But in early March of 1899, she's 18 years old, and her name's Mary Mason. So it's kind of at the back end of this crippling depression. She would have been, born and lived enough of her childhood, even to the age of about 10, in the context of her own family being, you know, comfortable and having a bit of wealth. And she took a job at the Marvel Laundry on Doveton Street in Ballarat. Now, the Doveton, the building itself is still there on Doveton Street in Ballarat. But it was a laundry at the time, and it was the kind of affair where you walk in the front, there's a counter, and you hand over your laundry, and it's cash register, and they take it to, the area where it's washed. But then every part of the buildings at the back is their own family's dwelling. Okay, so the family who owns the Marvel laundry live in the back. She's a very good-looking girl, and I'm gonna use her mugshot as the thumbnail for this podcast. So when you're looking at the thumbnail, that's Mary Mason. She's a good-looking girl, mousy brown hair and striking blue eyes from what the newspapers say. And newspapers love reporting on whether a female in court is attractive or not. And it's archaic. But that was just so normal at the time. Every part of the inference is that they have value to or against the case if they're attractive or ugly. And that's that Chappelle Corby thing, isn't it? There were so many other cases at the time where Australians found themselves in foreign prisons for drug smuggling, but Chappelle Corby was very attractive, and so she got a different set of treatments. And this kind of probably caught the media's attention around the time because of her youth and her good looks. So that I'm just going to put that right there. She was raised on her father's farm in an inland town in Victoria called Minyip. And the effects of the recession were what drove them off the land. This all happened when she was 14. A little bit before, though, her family started, suffering, and there were several years leading up to it, but by the time she was 14, she was finally off the land, and she was working in different service roles. So for the next 4 years until she's 18, she's had a string of roles, and that's a really... It puts a girl in a precarious place in that time and place in the world to have a string of employers. I remember going for my first jobs, and we would always take like a slip book full of resume letters and references. So your last boss would write a letter, and they'd call your boss and say, "Hey, did you write this?" "Yes, I did." They really checked heavily, but that letter itself was like gold, right, on letterhead. And you couldn't print your own letterhead; you had to get it printed at a printer's shop. So she'd struggle to have reference letters in the first place. So I'll say she's probably lucky to have the job she's got at the Marvel Laundry, but she also lives on site with the other staff. So this also plays in heavily into the case, right? So she lives on site at the Marvel Laundry with the staff and the family who own it. Now, it's possibly because of her manner towards her employers. She remained in roles they were menial kinds of roles, and it makes me think that it's possibly because she'd come from a lifestyle where she had staff on the farm working for her, or her parents at least, but she would never have had to have scrubbed anything, cleaned anything, and then all of a sudden that was happening to their family. She'd been put in the service role, and I get it, it probably would have been in her teen years as well, very difficult to adjust to. So that's the position she finds herself in, living with a foreign family as the help. And so she's working during the day, probably as much as 7 days a week, and then she would have to contribute to the household maintenance as in a service capacity as well. So it's like a 24-hour day indenture, really. By the time she began work at the Marvel Laundry, she found herself in a position where she was required to live in the rooms that were above the building. So it's a two-story building. And the building itself had no insurance for the furniture in it. That's probably a point worth making. So This is also an era where heating is exclusively done through wood fires. The newspaper reports say that some of the rooms in the houses, the walls, they're plastered with canvas, so like a wall covering, but the rest of them are papered. Now, that's to have wallpaper on the wall is it's a good sign, you know. So he's not doing poorly, this guy who runs the Marvel Laundry. The room adjoining the bedroom that Mary shared with her colleagues, so she's also sharing a bedroom with other staff. You know, so she's that room that adjoins their room. It went into the dining room, so she's got a communal wall next to the dining room, and the passage led from the front door to this room, and then it opened into a small laneway at the back. The door in the dining room was locked with Yale locks, unless it was meal times, and one of the bedrooms upstairs that was occupied by the three children of the owner, sorry, I should say there was a bedroom upstairs that was occupied by the three children, and the second two bedrooms were occupied by the employees of the Marvel Laundry. So you've got one bedroom with three kids, you've got two other bedrooms, each with two staff in it. And the third, two bedrooms, and the fourth were slept in by the owner and his wife. So there were 10 people in this shared accommodation in total. Probably the best way to put it. It's a lot of people in one house, particularly since only five of them are related. The rest of the other five are employees. So you've got two in one room, two in one, and I presume one in the third room. The door in the dining room was very close to where Mary slept at night. But then one night, during the night, all the residents in the residential part of the building heard loud frantic knocking on all the front doors, and you know, the people banging on the doors. So Thomas Keeley, who was the owner, he went straight down to the dining room where he saw the wallpaper burning under the window. The remains of the curtain were still smouldering on the floor as though they'd been pulled down, and he extinguished them by jumping up and down on them, and then he threw the curtains into the fireplace so they wouldn't burn anything else. All the remaining residents in the house, except for Mary, came into the room, and as you would, they were probably terrified. They had lamps, and they came in, and they kind of congregated there. And then I think probably by her absence, Mary was probably, the finger was probably pointed pretty quickly. Senior Constable Arnell was called onto the scene a short time later, and I think the situation that probably went down right about then was, we know who you're looking for, because she's not here. Middle of the night, not here. So as they stood regrouping in the dining room, one of the younger girls called attention to the smoke coming through a window between the dining and the storeroom. The storeroom door was closed when they tried to open it, but because it was locked. When they finally got it open, they found the room full of smoke, because the policeman pointed out that there was a piece of wood burning under the table. So it's firewood from the fireplace is now burning under the table. The floor where the piece of wood was and the skirting around the lining of the boards, they were all partly destroyed from fire because pieces of wood that were on fire had been just laid around the room. Behind the door, a match was found with a torn piece of the lining paper, the canvas from the wall. The police discovered that earlier in the day, the laundry owner, Thomas Keeley, had accused Mary of stealing a petticoat that had belonged to one of the customers from one of the washrooms. And that's probably, he was probably very quick to point that out, that he had this altercation with her, and that was probably her motive for what she'd done. But I think the thing also worth mentioning is that Mary denied it heavily. And there was always still a question as to whether she stole it, because the way it went down was that the girl she shared the room with on the second floor, her bedroom partner, she was the one who raised the alarm with the owner, Keeley. She said, look, she's got this this petticoat under her mattress. Now, I shared a room with my older brother and my younger brother until I was 17, shared rooms, and I don't think I ever looked under any of their mattresses ever, for any reason, just, So, you know, whether it's planted, and the first thing I think is that this girl's planted this petticoat out of spite underneath Mary's mattress. And it wouldn't have been just out of the blue. So these kinds of things, anybody ever says to me, I've had this traumatic fight with someone and I'm completely innocent and they're to blame for everything, I'm always suspicious of that. I've never seen a one-sided fight often. I have actually, but not often. It's usually, you know, you're in some kind of dispute or disagreement with somebody, you're usually a big part of the problem as well. That's just my experience. So this is probably built up over a period of time with niggling and, you know, arguments and all those kinds of things, until the roommate says, you know what, I'm done with this girl from the country who thinks she's better than us because she came from a farm where she had staff and now she thinks she's too good to... I'm going to frame her. That's just my own presumption, but that's kind of how I see it going down, right? But essentially, for whatever reason she did it, Mary almost killed 9 people in their sleep. The police got hold of her and they put her in questioning, but I'll just go back. If she had killed 9 people, or even 1 for that matter, it would have been a hanging crime. She would have hung. Might have gotten off because she was female. Again, they treated women differently to men back then. But she was extremely fortunate that they didn't, that the fire didn't kill them. Not just because the people would have died, but she would have also been killed as a result. So she was rounded up by the police, taken to the police station in Ballarat, and she gave a full confession to lighting the fires, but still said she didn't steal the petticoat. So then she headed off to, she was sent off to Old Melbourne Jail, and I'll let you read the rest in the book itself. It's in The Dawn of Crime, Volume 2, which is online. But I think that the issue that I faced with that article is one that keeps coming back again and again and again for me, right? I have the address of the Marvel Laundries in Ballarat. And instantly my knee-jerk reaction was the same as when I research other articles. And today I'm researching an article about a guy called Thompson. He was accused of shooting a guy in the head in a botched robbery in 1913. So now we're talking 107 years ago. The address is in Carlton, and the residence next door is lived in by the deceased guy's chauffeur. So the chauffeur lives next door to his boss, and I have that address too. And in the newspaper articles, it says, the last person to see the deceased alive was this man, and they name his address, his actual street address. So I've got 3 addresses now, and he saw him alive when they went to a pub to change some money, and they named the pub. And then during the night, 2 intruders showed up in the bedroom and demanded the money, which was hidden underneath his mattress. He said, it's my employer's money, you're not having it. He lunged out of bed to try and punch the attacker, and the attacker shot him in the head and killed him. Grabbed the money and split. So there's 3 addresses and a pub, right? Add that together with the laundry in Ballarat. Then there's another story that I wrote called A King Among Men in Volume 2 of The Dawn of Crime. And it's a horrific, long story about a criminal that ends up in Melbourne. And he's probably born as the son of slaves in America. He's from a state in America where slavery was still on its way out. And his parents were almost unquestionably slaves. He was a commercial sailor who was on a ship that docked in Melbourne, and he jumped ship. He was African American, and he was an incredibly competent boxer, but he was 6'2" when almost the rest of the country was under 6 foot. He was one of those people. I get people that have said to me, one person actually messaged me and said, look, when you say someone's a psychopath, do you know what that means? Now, I'm not going to say I'm qualified as a psychologist or anything like that, but by the definitions that I've seen in, you know, your typical places like Wikipedia and stuff, this guy ticks every box for both a sociopath and a psychopath. He thrilled himself in harming other people. The crimes that he committed were horrific, prolonged, and he got joy out of almost strangling a girl after he raped her. Then she came back to life and he was frustrated that he couldn't kill her and stayed there for nearly an hour trying to do so. Right. So this guy is a horrific guy. There are three different instances in his biography where they name the address where these horrific crimes took place. His death, incidentally, is fascinating, the way he dies. That's in the book, but I won't bore you with it. But he, the addresses of his story, so many of them are in just newsprint, right there for anybody to see and find. So then the ethical question I have is, my knee-jerk reaction is, I'm fighting every impulse not to call the people, or write to the people rather, and send them a letter who live there now with a photocopy of the article and say, hey guys, did you know this? I mean, like, I'd love to know that. But then again, I don't know what the lives of the people who live there now is like. I don't know what they're going through, whether that would be a trigger for them with something that they've already endured in their life. I don't know. I don't know this. And so the ethics on that is, for me, you know, how do you include someone in that story? I don't know. And I guess then the last part of this concept, I guess, that I'm talking about today in this podcast is that I found a picture recently of Gertrude Street, Fitzroy. And it's a photo of three house fronts. And they're still there. They were in the 1960s. They were in the last stages of being the bad days of Fitzroy, where they were just slums with, you know, 10, 20 people living in every address. The fronts were all falling down. Slum landlords had had them forever. But now they're beautiful multi-million dollar houses with stained glass in the windows and all sorts of things. And, you know, I've thought to myself, I'd love to go, when lockdown is finished, of course, I'd love to go and knock on a couple of these doors where these particular houses are linked to Squizzy Taylor, the gangster. And I'd love to know, hey guys, are there any marks on any of the walls? Is there anything in the attic? Is there anything that could link, that you've noticed since you moved in here, that link him to that? But then, you know, get some dude in his mid-40s knocking on your door saying, hello, I'm, you know, I don't know. So, look, I would welcome any of your comments or feedback, any of your thoughts at all about this topic in the, I'll post this on Facebook, of course, but I'd love to know any of your thoughts or feedback on what you think about this issue and whether I'm right to be concerned at all. But you've been listening to The Dawn of Crime. Check out the book series. They are online by Googling Roy Malloy and The Dawn of Crime.